toilet, but Jaime stood his ground. "Just a moment, Helenus." We turned to face Jaime, who held the 5 10-pound notes up in his hand. Just the hint of a smile played over his face. "I bet you 50 quid PK smacks your ass." Heldenhuis stood, his arms held stiffly as though at attention. He was rigid with anger. Jaime had outfoxed him and avenged himself at the same time. "You got your bet, Jew," he spat. Heldenhuis took us over to the shower block and pointed to a brown paper bag on a bench. "Everything's there. I'll see you in the gym." He turned and walked away, presumably to change elsewhere. "Christ, what a turn up for the books," Jaime said. The gear fitted well enough, and the boxing boots were nicely worn. We left the showers and walked down a long corridor toward the gym. I entered ahead of Jaime. Suddenly the hall resounded with clapping and whistling. It was packed to the rafters with Help Macar guys. "Holy shit," I exclaimed, turning to Jaime. Jaime glanced at the grinning faces looking at us. "Keep calm. Pretend you're not surprised. We don't want him to have the psychological advantage." Jaime, as usual, was thinking on his feet. We climbed up into the ring, and Jaime gloved me up. Helenes was already in his corner, throwing punches into the air. As usual, I sat on the pot and waited. The referee, a chap in his mid-twenties, called us into the center of the ring.
"Okay, boxers, shake hands. Break when I say break. A knockdown takes a compulsory count of 8. I don't start counting until you're in a neutral corner. 3 warnings on a foul, and the fight goes against you."
Neither of us were listening to him.
"This time I get you, Roenick," Yanni Helenus said out of the corner of his mouth. "This fight comes to you with the compliments of the Jew boy, poor bastard." I spat back.
"Ready, timekeeper. Seconds out of the ring."
The bell went and we danced towards each other. I could see Heldenhuis meant business. He had 5 defeats to avenge and his eyes were hard. Fighting in the enemy camp in front of a hostile crowd, I wasn't about to let him have the satisfaction. He was a naturally aggressive fighter, and I wasn't going to give him the opportunity of landing a few good punches early. So I spent the first half of round 1 on the back foot, using the ring and staying clear of the ropes. Later, Jaime told me the Help Macar kids were yelling their heads off, but it was as though I was fighting in a vacuum. My concentration was complete. Helenes threw a lot of leather, but most of it landed on my arms and gloves, though he did score with 2 punches. A beautiful uppercut as he caught me briefly on the ropes, and a right under the heart. Both punches hurt like hell. It was sheer luck that I hadn't had any lunch. St. John had had me for a tutorial which had gone an extra half hour, and so I'd missed lunch. I was willing to bet Heldenhuis hadn't eaten since morning. I caught Heldenhuis a beautiful punch on the jaw, which stopped him in his tracks. He had come at me with a careless left lead, and I brought my right hand across his lead to hit him hard on the side of the jaw. Yanni was a sucker for repeating a mistake, and later in the round he led again with a sloppy left. This time I came under the blow and caught him with everything I had under the heart. I could see his eyes boggle, and he staggered back into the ropes where I hit him with a left-right combination in the gut, expecting his gloves to open so that I could get an uppercut to the jaw. Instead, anticipating the uppercut, he defended his head, leaving his gut exposed. In went the heel-peat 8-punch combination, and he grabbed at the ropes just as the bell went. The first round was mine. Jaime had noticed the same thing as I had. Heldenhuis had developed a peculiar habit. In order to set himself for a left hook, he held his right elbow high, opening up his rib cage, and I'd given him a lot of punishment in the area right under the heart. The 8-punch combo was just what I needed to soften him up for later in the fight. As Heel Pete would say,
"If you hit them enough in between the heart and the belt, the legs will soon melt."
To my surprise, in the second round he continued to be the aggressor. I'd never seen him fight better. His punches were crisp, and finding their mark disconcertingly often. In the middle of the round, I changed to a southpaw stance. This confused him enough to get me through the round with no more punishment. And while I'd put a lot of hard work into his body, he'd won the round, I felt sure. When a fighter gets set and is able to move his opponent into the corners, He can do a lot of harm and look very good. I hate you to lose the second round. It gives your opponent the psychological advantage, knowing he's going into the last round with his tail up. Besides, it gives the referee a chance to call a draw if the final round isn't convincing. The extra weight Yanni had gained had increased his strength, and he had seemed to take in his stride the punishment I'd given him. Yanni knew he had to make the final round look good, and I knew I had to make it look great. As a fighter, he had the edge over a boxer, the aggressor moving relentlessly forward as a crowd-pleaser, and a partisan crowd is apt to forget the winner is the guy who lands the most clean punches. I hope the ref was good enough to call it correctly, but with a home crowd like this, a close decision in my favor would get us lynched. Yanni began the final round by circling me, boxing clever. I had switched back from a southpaw stance, and he was no match for me as a boxer, provided I stayed in the center of the ring and off the ropes. I held him off easily enough. He kept moving in close, trying to throw the left hook to the head, the punch he'd decided would take me out. I could have kept him off with a straight right, just jabbing away and scoring, but I felt I was fast enough to keep my head out of the way of his vicious left hook, which every time he threw it, lifted his right elbow and made a delicious target for me to plant a hard left uppercut under his heart. To a percentage boxer like me, this was money in the bank. Geldenhuis threw another hard left hook, which caught me a glancing blow on the side of the head. I didn't even have to look. The right elbow would be way up in the air, and I drove a left hook in as hard as I could. The light suddenly left his eyes. Giel Piet was right as usual. His head had gone. I changed onto the front foot and into attack. The sudden onslaught caught Geldenhuis completely by surprise, and gaps in his defense opened up everywhere. His concept of me, as a boxer who worked mostly off the back foot, was so completely fixed in his mind that he was unable to respond to the fighter who now brought the fight to him, hitting him seemingly at will. He dropped his defenses as he reached out too soon for a clinch, and I caught him on the point of the jaw with a right cross, which knocked him into the ropes, leaving his midriff exposed as his hands shot up into the air. I moved in with another of Giel Piet's 8-punch combinations, all of them clean, hard punches, even though they were thrown at short range. He pulled me into a clinch, and the ref separated us. I'd taken the stuffing out of him, and 30 seconds later he missed with a right and the left that followed, and I hit him with the best punch I had thrown in my life, a right uppercut which packed everything I had behind it, and caught him perfectly under the point of the chin. It was the first absolute knockout I'd ever achieved. Yanni Geldenhuis went down like a sack of potatoes and lay sprawled on the canvas. I retired quickly to a neutral corner. While he hadn't moved, I fully expected him to take the 8 count before getting up. The ref stood over him, counting. At 7, Geldenhuis managed to get up onto his elbow, but that was all. At 10, he slumped back onto the canvas. The ref moved over and held my hand up. The audience was clearly stunned. After their initial shock, and as Yanni got to his feet, they stood up and gave me a really big round of applause. Jaime jumped into the ring and held my arm up again, which was unnecessary. Yanni Geldenhuis, helped by his seconds, climbed through the ropes without coming over. I grinned. Christ, Jaime, what a preliminary for getting the punters ready to bet on a game of rugby. Couldn't be better if I'd set it up myself, he said. We climbed from the ropes, and the Help Macar chaps made way for us as we walked towards the door. Promise me something, Jaime.
Yeah, sure, what is it?
Promise me you didn't set all this up.
Are you crazy? What about that anti-Semitic bastard?
You got your revenge. That was the quickest 50 quid anybody ever had. We had reached the privacy of the showers, and Jaime started to giggle. Soon we were thumping each other on the back and howling with laughter. On the way back in the bus, I turned to Jaime.
You haven't answered my question.
What question?
Was today a setup?
Jaime looked down at his hands.
Technically, no. But when you bring the right elements together, you're entitled to expect a predictable outcome.
I ought to bust your teeth, Jaime Solomon Levy. I ought to do it right now.
We repeated the attractive odds at the Prince of Wales, and as we expected, the gentlemen Christians bet heavily on Help Macar to win.
School spirit was one thing, but money was quite another. Only the Wellington House boarders, Darby and Sarge, and the under-15 team itself bet on the Prince of Wales School. Setting the odds up, as we had done, had the result of inspiring the under-15s enormously. The David and Goliath syndrome was operating. Jaime's psychology was perfect. By the day of the game, we really thought we could win. At Help Macar, it was hoped that it would have a different effect, for while the Afrikaans punters bet heavily on their team to win, the team itself should have felt a little uneasy. Why would we make the Prince of Wales School the favourite, when virtually the same team we were fielding had been beaten on 4 previous occasions? Like ours, their team contained a number of boxers in its ranks, and they'd seen how we had improved out of sight in the ring, to the point where we had drawn the last boxing tournament with them. If we could do it in boxing. Jaime and I were known not to be fools. Jaime's poison, we hoped, was working. Despite being only an under-15s match, the game drew the biggest crowd of the season. The punters from both schools were out in full, and Jaime was still taking bets when the two teams were lined up on the field. He had even got the school pipe major to play Scotland the Brave out in the middle before we ran on. It was grand stuff. The ref blew his whistle, and Atherton kicked off. A short kick which landed in the middle of their forwards. Pissy Johnson, by some miracle, got there first, and bowled over the Help Macar forward who caught the ball. A loose scrum formed, but the ball wouldn't come out, and the ref blew his whistle for a set scrum. It was our loose head, and despite a big push from Help Macar, the ball came to me quite cleanly. We were halfway between the halfway mark and their 25, and Atherton was standing almost on the halfway line directly behind me. I knew he was going to go for the drop kick, which even for him seemed a bit ambitious. I flipped the ball back at him as their flankers broke away, and seemingly with time to spare, he put the ball straight through the posts for 4 points. It was the best drop kick I had ever seen from him, and it set the tone of the match. Shortly afterwards, we scored a converted try, and just before half-time, they landed a free kick. At half-time, it was 9-3, but their heavier pack was taking its toll, and we were exhausted. In the second half, they closed down the game and eventually scored by pushing our lighter pack over the line. It was 9-8 with 10 minutes to go, and I could see our forwards were dead on their feet. It was just a matter of time before they scored. Somehow we hung on, tackling everything in sight. Jaime had the pipe major on the sideline, and he was blasting away, but we were too tired to care or even hear him. Geldenhuis had given me a torrid time and was over-anxious to get at me. On 2 occasions during these last minutes of the game, when they were camped on our line, I dummied a pass from the scrum, and his over-eagerness to get at me put him offside and gave us a free kick. These 2 relieving kicks alone may well have saved us. With 2 minutes to go, we packed down for a scrum on our 5-yard line. It was our loose head, but they were pushing us hard towards the line. Somehow we managed to ruck the ball. I dummied a pass to our fullback, and Geldenhuis hesitated for a fraction of a second, enough time for me to move down the blind side. I drew their wing and passed to Atherton, who'd come round with me. He cut inside, drew their fly half, and kicked the ball across the field towards the far corner posts. Lyle, our right winger, beat the fullback to the ball and scored in the corner. The Prince of Wales School went berserk, despite the fact that they'd lost all their money. Atherton failed to convert the try, but we'd won 12-8. When all the bets were counted, and we'd paid the faithful handful who'd bet against Help Macar, we were left with £487.15 and 6p. Of the 1,800 kids in the 2 schools, almost every one of them had a bet on the outcome. It was the mightiest scam of all time, and my share paid Solly Goldman for the next 3.5 years. Jaime broke out a fiver for a party in the team dressing room, and sent Geldenhuis and the Help Macar team a case of Pepsi and 4 dozen cream buns. He opened a cream bun and placed a tenner in it, and put it on top of the pile of buns going to Help Macar dressing room. "That will teach the hairyback to do business with a Jew boy," he laughed. The Solly Goldman gym in Zara Street was just like any gym you've read about. It smelt of sweat, chalk, liniment, and hope. Solly ran his gym colorblind, the way gyms are run the world over. His only concession to apartheid was a locker room for non-Europeans. The rest depended on your skill as a boxer. The Johannesburg police turned a blind eye to Solly's personal race integration program. The police commissioner, Kruger, was a boxing man,
and to boxing men, black isn't black in the ring. Too many great black boxers existed in the world, and a man jabbing a pair of 12-ounce gloves into your face wasn't a dirty kaffir, he was a boxer, if only for the duration of the fight. While a number of amateurs worked out in the gym, none of them was instructed by Solly, who had his work cut out handling the pros. Boxing was becoming a big-time sport in the African townships surrounding Johannesburg, and Solly had a regular stable of black fighters he trained in return for a percentage of the purse. Black and white boxers were not allowed to fight in public for the same title, but they'd spar together, and sometimes the sparring would get out of hand when a white or a black guy, but it was mostly the white boxers, decided to have a go. Solly would let it go for a couple of rounds, particularly when it looked as though the white man was getting a bit of a drubbing. The first time Jaime and I appeared, Solly put me in with a young pro bantamweight who hadn't been out of the amateur ranks very long. After two rounds, he stopped the sparring session.
"Who taught you to box, PK?"
I told him about Heel Pete without giving him the exact details.
"Next time you see him, my boy, you give him my compliment."
"He's dead, Solly." Solly cocked his bald head to one side.
"Well, he didn't die in vain, my son. He's given you an almost perfect grounding. You use the ring like a wizard."
"Thank you," I said, not quite knowing what else to say. Solly Goldman was the best, and I found his over-generous compliments unnerving.
"Thank me later, my boy. There's a lot of work to get through. You need a little more starch in your left hand, and your right is no great shakes neither. Like all amateurs, you're looking for points. You hold your hands too bleeding high. You're fast enough to drop them a little and give yourself more punching power. We'll get you onto weights and build up your upper body. It would also be very comforting indeed to know you also packed a good left-right combination. Before I'm through with you, my son, you're going to be the only amateur boxer in South Africa who can put a 13-punch combo together. That's the showstopper. That's the one-man band that starts with a bleeding mouth organ and ends with a big bass drum."
I was amazed that Solly Goldman, a Cockney Jew from London, could read so much into my boxing after watching me for only two rounds. But he was true to his word. By the Christmas holidays, I was a vastly improved boxer with a lot more power in both hands. We fought as usual in the Eastern Transvaal Championships that December, and Captain Smith couldn't believe the difference. The championships were in Barberton, and it seemed the whole town turned out to see me box. My mother stayed at home, but my grandpa had a ringside seat with Doc, Mrs. Boxall, Miss Bornstein, and old Mr. Bornstein. Miss Bornstein told me later that old Mr. Bornstein winced every time I threw a punch, while Doc, by now a seasoned campaigner, pretended to take it all in his stride. I was awarded the trophy for best boxer in the tournament, and afterwards my grandpa and I walked home while Mrs. Boxall drove Doc to his cottage. We reached the front gate, and my grandpa patted me on the shoulder.
"I've never been so proud in my life, son," he said, and then, to cover his embarrassment, reached into his white linen jacket for his pipe.
I had been home a week. The train from Johannesburg arrived at Nelspruit at 9 a.m. on the previous Saturday morning. Usually I would then go on to Kaapmuiden and wait until mid-afternoon for the coffee pot to Barberton, which would crawl exhausted into town about 8 in the evening. But to my delight, Gert was waiting for me at Nelspruit.
"Ach, man, we had to put in some papers here about the white drunk and disorderly who attacked the prison gang with a pick handle. So Captain Smuts said take the car and pick up PK at the same time."
He extended his hand.
"How goes it, man?"
On the road back to Barberton, Gert told me that Doc had been in a storm in the hills and had caught pneumonia and spent a week in hospital.
"He's looking old, PK. I reckon he'll be making his peace pretty soon."
I was stunned.
"He's a tough old bugger. He'll be okay, I'm telling you," I said, more to give myself comfort than as a reply.
"Yeah, he's tough all right, but the old bugger must be 85, maybe more. He can't last forever, man."
"Well, he's still climbing into the hills, that's something at least."
"Not since he was sick. He talks about it, about when you get back, but I don't know, man. I reckon he's finishing klar. I told him I'd send a gang any time to work in the cactus garden, but he says he can still manage. But I don't know, man."
I said nothing. A huge lump grew in my throat, and the road in front of me blurred. The thought of Doc not being there when I returned home from school was too distressing even to contemplate.
Those two Abafazi at your house look after him like he's a chief. They spend all their spare time over at his place, and they bring food every day, and now they even shave him.
Doc was the most independent person I'd ever known, and I knew at once that Gert wasn't imagining things. If Dee and Dam had to shave him, his hands must have become very shaky. I had bought Dee and Dam a Singer hand machine, and they'd turned their sewing into a regular little business, making cotton shifts for many of the local house servants. My mother and Marie had shown them how to cut out and how to make buttonholes and hem by hand, and they were going great guns. I had learnt by accident that Dee and Dam were using their small earnings from sewing to look after Doc, who could no longer take in his little girls for music lessons. When I could after that, I would send them money for him. The bank was a regular source of income, and I could generally manage a pound a week, and what with one or two other scams Jaime and I had going, between the girls and me, Doc was okay. Realizing that my mother would expect me home on the coffee pot, I asked Gert to drop me off at the bottom of Doc's road. Hiding my suitcase under some bushes, I climbed up to the cottage. He was sitting in the shade on the stoop in his favorite Rimpi chair, and I thought he must be asleep. But he looked up and saw me approaching, and rose from his chair a little stiffly, one hand on the small of his back. His 6'7" frame almost touched the rafters of the veranda, and he seemed to be swaying slightly as his arms went out to me. I ran up to him, and he put his hands on my shoulders, and then I could no longer contain myself, and I grabbed him fiercely.
"Please, Doc. Please don't die," I sobbed.
Doc and I seldom showed emotion. Our love, each for the other, was so fierce that it burnt like a flame inside of us. But now I was suddenly overcome. Gert's conversation on the way over, mixed with the emotion of seeing him standing with his arms outstretched to me, frail as a wisp of smoke, was too much. His hand came round and patted me on the back.
"Absolute. We have no time to die, PK. The hills are still green and waiting. It is not yet time for the Crystal Cave of Africa."
I pulled away from him and he sat down in his chair. Still sniffing, I wiped my eyes with the back of my hand.
"You've been sick, Doc. Gert told me you've been sick."
"Just a bad cold, PK. It was nothing."
"It was pneumonia."
"Yeah, this is true, but some pneumonia is big, some is small. This was a pickaninny, a very small pneumonia, for sure and absolute."
He rose again from the chair.
"Come, I make coffee, PK."
"Marie will tell me how bad it was." Doc threw up his hands.
"Marie, such a person!
Professor, you must give your life to Jesus. There's not much time. You must choose between the eternal damnation of hellfire or the love of Jesus Christ."
"I think maybe I stay a little longer here, miss," I say to this Marie. "I think she was quite a lot disappointed." "Yeah, I think so," Doc said, chuckling as he poured a mug of strong black coffee for me,
holding the coffee pot in both hands to stop himself shaking. We sat on the veranda sipping our coffee in big tin mugs, Doc's only half full so he wouldn't spill it. He was up to all his tricks to hide his frailty. We said very little. I could see Doc was happy I was back, and I felt I would give him strength. We talked about the Crystal Cave of Africa, which Doc now regarded as our greatest discovery.
"It is good we are together again, PK. On Christmas Day, I will be 87 years old."
"Doc, you've got to live until I'm welterweight champion of the world. You've got to make it until you're at least 94 or 5. Doc chuckled at the urgency in my voice and rose slowly from his chair.
"Come. I show you Pachypodium namaquanum. It grows so big, maybe we can have the world champion here also."
As we walked together into the cactus garden, Doc still tall and straight as Pachypodium namaquanum himself, there seemed to be a little more spring in his step.
"Next week we will go into the mountains, PK. It has been too long."
We did, mostly skirting the foothills and taking the easy paths,
but Doc seemed to gain strength and was much better by the time I returned to school in mid-January. 21. 1948 was a great year in South Africa's history. Princess Elizabeth had recently toured, and we'd all stood beside the road and waved flags and caught a glimpse of our future queen as she rode past in a long, black, open Rolls-Royce. It was the year South Africa got white bread, an event which excited a lot more people than catching a glimpse of the future Queen of England. History will tell of how the election of the Nationalist Party, who still hold power in South Africa 40 years later, was the turning point when the Afrikaner once again became the dominant force in the country. History is bound to treat this event with great pontification, showing how the struggle between the two white tribes of Africa reached its climax. In fact, the turning point came not because of an ideological clash between white and white, but because the Nationalists promised to bring back white bread to replace the healthier whole wheat loaf which had been introduced during the war. An already overfed white minority elected to vote on its stomach. Within a week of being elected, the Nationalists kept their promise, and white South Africans derived great satisfaction from knowing that for once they had a new government which kept its word. Meanwhile, the black South Africans prepared to bend their backs to the shambok, and for the invention of a new game where they voluntarily fell on their heads from the third story of police headquarters to the pavement below. It was curious that the whites, renowned for their sporting prowess, never learnt how to play this game, and there isn't a single instance of a white South African becoming proficient at it. Nobody ever got their springbok blazer for this new national game, even though a lot of very good heads played it with great courage. Jaime, in a grim pun, said the election of the Nationalists to power was one of the crummiest moments in the history of any people. 1948 was the year South Africa lost all hope of joining the Brotherhood of Man. Yet the black man held his humiliation and his anger at bay. It was not until 1952, 4 years later, that Chief Luthuli of the African Congress and his counterpart, Dr. Monty Naika of the Indian Congress, led the black and coloured people in the first defiance campaign, where the words, "Mayibuye Africa," became the cry of the black man, asking for an equal share of justice and dignity for himself and his family. Private schools have a habit of carrying on regardless, oblivious to social or political change. Had it not been for a boxing incident, which led to the establishment of a Saturday night school for Africans, the Prince of Wales School would certainly have remained smugly wrapped in its cocoon of privilege and white supremacy. The incident happened during the 10-day Easter break in 1949. Jaime's parents decided to spend the Jewish Passover with relatives in Durban. Jaime elected to stay home and invited me to spend the short holidays with him. I wrote to Mrs. Boxall, who wrote back to say Doc was well, so I agreed. The cook and the rest of the staff would take care of us, and one of the chauffeurs would drive us the 40 miles from Pretoria to Johannesburg every day to work out in Solly Goldman's gym. Solly protested, but we insisted he be paid extra for the holidays. Jaime's entrepreneurial sense extended to all things. He'd go to Barclays Bank in Yeovil on Saturday morning and demand a brand new £5 note. Keeping it unfolded, he'd place it beside the week's entry in a large leather-bound ledger. On Sunday morning, after I'd worked out, we'd go into Solly's ramshackle office, and Jaime would open the ledger where he had written in his neat, precise hand, "Paid to S. Goldman £5 for services rendered." He would make Solly sign the ledger and remove the £5 note from the page. Then they'd shake hands solemnly like a couple of little old men, whereupon Solly would get his revenge by stuffing the pristine £5 note carelessly into the back pocket of his dirty grey flannels. Solly was a very natty street dresser, but in the gym he always wore a sweatshirt and the same old grey flannels, tied around the waist with a frayed brown striped tie. "Why do you go to all that trouble when he just shoves it into his back pocket?" I once asked Jaime. "So he'll stick it carelessly into his back pocket. Every week my stupid ritual and his defiance reminds him not to take us for granted. Every time he sticks it into his back pocket like that, I know he won't." On the third day of the Easter holidays, Solly asked whether he could see Jaime and me in his office. He pointed to two old cane upright chairs, and pushing a pile of papers out of the way,
sat in the corner of a desk, covered to a depth of 6 inches in evenly distributed paper. In addition to boxing bills, unopened letters and general paper clutter, there was a bronze cup about 10 inches high, green with verdigris, a telephone and a large desk blotter added to the mess. The telephone sat on top of the desk blotter, which was covered with coffee rings and hundreds of names and numbers. If anyone had ever replaced the top layer of blotting paper, Solly's gym would have ground to a halt.
"You've had an offer of a fight for PK in Sapphire Town next Saturday night. It's not my decision, mind, but it can't do the lad no harm."
"Sapphire Town? You mean the Black Township?"
"Yeah. I'll admit it's a bit unusual. It's a young black bantam who's just turned pro."
"Solly, are you crazy? PK's an amateur, he can't fight a pro."
"The black kid's not from up here. He isn't registered in the Transvaal yet. Technically, he's an amateur here. Anyway, if the fight takes place in a native township, who the hell's going to know?"
"You should know better than that, Solly."
Ignoring Jaime's remark, Solly appealed directly to me.
"This fight would do you a lot of good. Sharpen you up nicely for the South African Schools Championships and all."
"Christ, Solly, you're off your rocker,"
Jaime continued.
"You find a professional bantamweight, probably in his 20s, and you want to put him against PK, who's 15 years old."
"That's just the point, my son. PK wouldn't be mismatched. The black kid is only just 16. 3 professional fights. Would I mismatch PK? Don't insult my intelligence."
"Hey, hang on. Wait a minute, both of you." I turned to Solly. "There's more to this, isn't there? First, we're fighting a black man in a black township. That's not allowed for a start. Then an amateur is fighting a pro."
"An unregistered pro," Solly interjected.
"You haven't answered my question, Solly," I repeated.
"It's not what you're thinking, PK. There's no money in it. There would be no purse for the fight."
"What about the book?" Jaime asked.
"No betting neither, God's honour."
Solly folded his hands on the desk in front of him and stared down at the untidy blotter.
"We're waiting, Solly," Jaime said.
"It's Nguni. He wants the fight. Mr. Nguni."
"Who's he when he's at home?" I asked.
"He's a black fight promoter. Owns the game in the black townships."
"So what's that to us?" I asked. Solly looked up at me.
"He reckons if he was to match you with this Mandoma bloke, it would be a terrific fight, that's all."
"If you'll come clean with the real reason you want this fight, we could discuss it. What is it, Solly?" I asked again. Solly threw his hands up.
"Okay, it's business. Mr. Nguni brings in the blacks, I train them, we share in the action. When you've got 15% of 50 black fighters on the black township circuit, it's a nice little earner. I don't honestly know why he wants this fight. I admit it don't make a lot of sense."
Jaime spoke as though he were thinking aloud.
"The black guy is squeezing you, and now you're putting the hard word on us. I can understand that, but even if he is making a book, and you say he isn't, that's not a big enough reason. He could lose his boxing promoter's license if he got caught."
"Jaime's right, Solly. There has to be a better reason. Nguni is either a fool or he's taking an enormous risk for a reason we don't know about. Either way, we wouldn't want to get involved. By the way, this Mandoma, is he a Zulu? I had a nanny named Mandoma."
"Buggered if I know. Until they earn me a quid, they're just black monkeys wearing boxing gloves,"
Solly said absently. Jaime's chauffeur was waiting in the Buick, which was parked on a vacant lot a block away. As we walked to the car, Jaime kept shaking his head.
"I don't get it. This Nguni guy would have to be crazy to take the risk of putting on a fight between a nigger pro and an amateur white guy in a black township. The cops would have him on about 10 counts. I mean, what's the angle? A 15-year-old schoolboy boxer and a 16-year-old black bantamweight is not exactly big time, even in a black township."
"You haven't figured it out, have you?" I said quietly.
"No, not yet, but I will."
"Don't bother. It's got something to do with the people." Jaime spun around and grabbed me.
"You're right, PK. The tadpole angel."
We turned into the vacant lot to find the Buick shining like a great black beetle among the cut-down 44-gallon drums half-filled with solid tar, piles of bricks, and the accumulated debris that seems to furnish vacant city blocks. The chauffeur was talking with a tall, well-dressed African, and stepped forward as he saw us approaching. Well, we're going to know what the scam is in about 30 seconds. Look who's here, Jaime. The tall black man straightened slightly as we came up. He was the tall African who always led the people in the chant to the tadpole angel.
"This man, he wants to speak you, Baz,"
the chauffeur said to me. "I see you," I said in Zulu to the African who towered above me.
"I see you, Nkosi," he replied, and shook my extended hand lightly, barely touching it.
Politeness required that we talk about other things before coming to the reason he wanted to speak to me. This is the Zulu way. "The weather has been hot, and the rains have not come. Where I come from, the crops will be thirsty."
"It is so also in my place. The herd boys will need to drive the cattle far from the kraal to find grazing, and the river will be dry but for a few water holes."
"What's he saying?" Jaime chipped in. "Nothing yet. We're still talking about the weather." "Your kraal is a far place from here?"
"Many, many miles, Nkosi. My kraal is near Ulundi in Zululand.
The royal homesteads of 3 out of the 4 great Zulu kings, Dingane, Mpande, and Sechweyo, had been near Ulundi, and the chances were that the tall man in front of me was a high-born Zulu. It is a long way from your wives and children. It is not good to be away from them."
"It is the custom, Nkosi. For the white man's pound, the black man must leave his family. These are hard times, and I have few cattle and land."
The time had come to introduce myself. "I am PK," I said softly, extending my hand for a second time.
"I know this, Nkosi. I am Nguni."
We shook hands a second time, this time first in the conventional manner, and then by slipping the hand over the corresponding thumb, to grip it in a kind of salute, which is a traditional African handshake.
"I see you, Nguni."
"I see you, PK."
It was audacious of Nguni to call me by my name, but I didn't mind. I felt as though he had known me a long time, anyway. "Is it about the business of the boxing in Sophiatown?"
"It is so,"
Nguni confirmed softly. "Can we speak in English so my friend can share this talk?" Nguni laughed, showing a brilliant smile.
"My English, she is not so good," he said in English.
Nguni's English turned out to be very good, and Jaime seemed relieved that he could share in the conversation. "It's about the Sophiatown business," I said to him.
"Ask him. No, wait on. I'll ask him myself.
Jaime, this is Mr. Nguni." I turned to Nguni. "This is my best friend, Jaime Levy."
"How do you do?"
Nguni said to Jaime, instinctively not extending his hand, but bowing his head slightly instead.
"How's it?"
Jaime said, not yet used to the idea of meeting a black man on equal terms.
"Why did you ask Mr. Goldman if you could arrange a fight with Pique?"
Nguni looked surprised.
"It is always so in boxing, to ask the trainer."
"I'm the manager. It is me you have to ask."
Nguni threw back his head and laughed.
"We knew this thing. But also, if your trainer, he say this thing cannot happen, I do not think you will listen."
"What did you offer him to make him agree?"
"It is not necessary. He has boxing business, same like me."
"How many boxes have you got, Mr. Nguni?"
"All,"
Nguni replied simply.
"You're not bullshitting me. You control all township boxes?"
Nguni turned to me and said in Zulu,
"Your friend has no respect, Nkosi."
"I apologize for him, Nguni. He acts only like a white man from the city." I turned to Jaime.
"Turn it up."
Jaime shook his head.
"Sorry, Mr. Nguni, no hard feelings, eh? This fight you want, it's just that it doesn't bloody well make sense."
Nguni turned to me and spoke in Zulu. I will have to explain it in Zulu. This man, I think, he does not understand the ways of the people.
Mr. Nguni is going to explain the reason to me in Zulu. It's evidently pretty complicated, I said to Jaime.
You are onoshobishobi ingelosi,
Nguni began.
This is very powerful among the people. The people see you box only against the Boer, and always you are winning also. The people think you are a great chief of their tribe. The Sotho think this, the Shangaan think this, the Zulu also, all the people.
He paused.
I think this also. It is witnessed that you can make the stars fall from the heavens.
It is not true, Nguni. I am not a chief of the people, I said quickly.
Who is to say what is true and what is not true? The people know these things. It is not for you to say, Nkosi.
It's about the tadpole angel. We were right, I said to Jaime.
There is a woman who has thrown the bones and made a fire to read the smoke,
Nguni said suddenly.
The bones say, Onoshobishobi Ingelosi, who is a chief, must fight him who is also a chief among the people.
A witch doctor, she said this.
This is so, Nkosi.
This chief, who is this chief I must fight?
He's the great-great-grandson of Sechwayo.
Psh, many such Zulus exist. Sechwayo has surely many, many great-great-grandsons.
He is the one,
Nguni said quietly. The Zulus do not inherit titles, but it is known who has the blood.
One day, he will be a chief.
Why is it necessary to fight this person who will one day be a chief?
The people must see if the spirit is still with you. You are a man now. The people knew the spirit of a great chief was in the small one, but now they must know if it is still in the man.
You mean if I lose to him who will be a chief, then I will no longer be Onoshobishobi Ingelosi?
This is so, Nkosi. The woman says this is in the bones and in the smoke.
Then I will lose, I said suddenly. That way the legend will be dead.
Nguni shrugged his shoulders. It is not for me to say, Nkosi. You will only lose if you are not Noshobishobi Ngelosi.
But if you can arrange the fight, it will be good for you as a promoter. Nguni looked down at the palms of his open hands, which were almost yellow, the color of sunlight soap.
This is true. But it is expected I should do this thing. Have I not led the people to all your fights?
This is true. You are the one, I said, ashamed of myself.
Then you will fight.
First we must talk to Jaime. He is my brother in this matter.
I understand. It is right that it should be so.
Jaime was clearly impatient to get a translation, and when I told him what had been said, he shook his head. Christ, it's witchcraft, PK. This is 1949. Yeah, I know. But it might as well be 1849. Some things don't change. So what do we do? He asked. We fight. We have no choice. I don't understand. Why? It's difficult for you, but the people believe in the tadpole angel. I've never said this before, but it's a symbol of hope. There is a story amongst all the tribes that a chief will rise who is not of them, but will unite them against the oppressors.
It is so, Mr. Levy, Nguni said.
And this is the test to see if you're kosher. I laughed despite myself. Jaime, I didn't start this. It just happened. I don't want it any more than you. If the young Zulu chief Mandoma gives me a hiding, it's all over. But I can't walk away without the fight. That would make a fool of the people all these years. I couldn't do that. What a shit of a posse to be in. But it's not a good enough reason to throw the fight. You know me better than that, Jaime. I turned to Nguni and offered him my hand. Mr. Nguni, tell the people I will fight this one who will be a chief.
I will tell the people, he said.
I set about preparing for the fight with Mandoma the Zulu bantamweight, with all the vigor and purpose I could command. While I longed to be rid of the concept involving the tadpole angel, it was quite impossible for me to bring myself to the point where I would throw the fight. I had steeled myself to win so often that in my mind a single loss in the ring would have meant that I would not become the welterweight champion of the world. A childish concept, perhaps, but nevertheless one which was bound with steel wire through my resolve. I had even taught myself never to consider the consequences of losing a fight. Too much cross-referencing of consequence robs the will of its single-minded concentration to win. While this fanatical resolve never to be beaten may have been a sign of immaturity, the sophistication I brought to the task of winning I was to see adopted by sports psychiatrists throughout the world in later years. The mental exercises adopted, first behind the Iron Curtain and then worldwide, in an attempt to win that endless Cold War called the Olympic Games or any of the other master race events, were all familiar to me. The greatest difficulty confronting me with the Mandoma fight was information. We knew nothing about the Zulu bantamweight. I always felt awkward going into a fight with an unknown opponent. It was like entering a dark room, having been told to beware of the trapdoors. If you know everything there is to know about an opponent, your mind will do the fighting for you, triggering the body mechanism to do the things it needs to do a fraction faster. It is this fraction that makes for a winner. The power of one is above all things the power to believe in yourself, often well beyond any latent ability you may have previously demonstrated. The mind is the athlete. The body is simply the means it uses to run faster or longer, jump higher, shoot straighter, kick better, swim harder, hit further or box better. Hoppy's dictum to me, first with the head and then with the heart, was more than simply mixing brains with guts. It meant thinking well beyond the powers of normal concentration, and then daring your courage to follow your thoughts. Saturday arrived. The fight was to take place in a ring set up in an African school soccer field in Sophiatown. We arrived about 4:30 on the outskirts, where Mr. Nguni was waiting for us. The roads were dusty and it had been a hot day. Dust clung to the whitewashed walls of shanties and shops, and everywhere there were advertising signs for Gold Seal cooking lard, blue light paraffin, primer stoves, drum tobacco and sunlight soap. There were a few trucks on the road, and we saw one native taxi and several buses, crowded to the point of bulging, though hundreds of people were on bicycles. The chauffeur kept an almost constant hand on the horn, which only seemed to add to the sense of excitement. As we drew closer to the school, people were lining the dusty narrow streets, which seemed to weave haphazardly in among the shanties, built from every conceivable kind of material. Mr. Nguni requested I turn my window down so the people could see me. Blushing, I complied.
You are very famous in this place, Piquet. The people have come for many, many miles to see you.
Why are they all women and children? Jaime asked.
It is the men who will see the fight. The women, they have come to see the Onoshobishobi Ngelosi.
Christ, I had no idea. You're more famous than Johnny Ralph, Piquet. Johnny Ralph was the reigning heavyweight champion of South Africa and a household name among whites. Mr. Nguni laughed.
Johnny Ralph, they do not know who is this boxer in Sophiatown.
Mr. Nguni, I said, you must tell the people I am not a chief. I have no power. You must tell them that the Onoshobishobi Ngelosi is only a name. A name I was given at the prison in Barberton. It was for nothing. Mr. Nguni turned to me in the back seat. He was clearly shocked.
I cannot do this thing, Nkosi. It is not for me to say who is Onoshobishobi Ngelosi. Tonight we will see. We cannot change this thing. It is in the bones and in the smoke.
He turned back to the chauffeur to give a direction.
Shit, he believes it himself,
Jaime said out of the corner of his mouth. We turned into the school grounds and were met by a sea of Africans. The Buick was forced to inch its way through the crowd. It was an hour and a half before the fight, and the soccer ground was totally full, with only a narrow aisle leading to the ring in the center. There must have been 10,000 spectators, with more pouring through the school gates.
"I thought you said it would be a fight in a school,"
Jaime said to Mr. Nguni.
"I thought you meant a school hall or something. The whole of Africa has come to see the bloody fight. What if there's trouble, a riot or something?"
"No, no, no trouble here, Mr. Levy. The woman, she will speak to the people."
"You mean the witch doctor?" I asked.
"It is she, Piquet. She will speak to the people."
Jaime grinned nervously.
"It's got to be the first time a witch doctor has ever announced a fight. Are you sure you've told me everything there is to know about you, Piquet?"
I grabbed him by the shirt front.
"Don't you start now."
We were taken to a shower block to change. Solly Goldman was waiting for us.
"They're doing it kosher, all right. They've got Nat Kim Patel, the Indian referee from Durban, to handle the fight. Blimey, have you seen the crowd?"
I changed, and we walked along to the school hall for the weigh-in. Jaime looked at the scales. They'd been borrowed from a local trader, and were the kind on which bags of mealy-meal are usually weighed.
"What's the bloody difference? We're going to fight him anyway, even if he's over the limit," Jaime said.
"It is very important, Mr. Levy. The people must know everything is correct,"
Mr. Nguni said. Standing in the middle of the school hall beside the scales were a dozen or so Africans, all neatly dressed in suits and ties. Though the suit parts were not always of the same parentage, they were clean and pressed. Standing to one side was Gideon Mandoma, the Zulu bantamweight I was to fight. I broke away from Solly and Jaime and walked over to him and extended my hand.
"I see you, Gideon Mandoma," I said in Zulu.
Gideon Mandoma took my hand, barely shaking it. He did not look up as he replied.
"I see you, Piquet."
"I hear you come from the Tugela River Valley. It is where my nanny came from when I was a small infant. Her name was Mary Mandoma. Was she from the same chief's kraal, perhaps?" Gideon Mandoma looked up at me, his eyes wide, a shocked expression on his face.
"The one you are asking about is my mother. She's dead now 5 years."
He pointed a finger at me.
"You are the one of the night water."
It was my turn to be shocked. I stood in front of the Zulu fighter, completely stunned. I was going to fight Nanny's son, the infant she had had to leave to look after me. It was I who had stolen the milk from her breasts when she had been hired to be first my wet nurse and then my nanny. Gideon was the first to recover.
"They say you are a chief, but must prove you have the spirit of Onoshobishobi Ngelosi. I know I am a chief, and have the spirit of Sechwayo, and before that of Mpande, Dingane, and even of Shaka, the king of all the kings."
His eyes grew suddenly hard. He had waited a long time, and now he would fight the one who had taken his mother from him so that he had not known her until he was 6 years old. It was not meant to be like this, but for him there was now an added reason to win. To the Zulu there is no such thing as coincidence. I knew this would be a certain and powerful sign for him. Gideon Mandoma had a reason greater than my own to win. For the first time in my boxing career, I was afraid. I knew Mandoma could beat me. We weighed in front of Solly, Mr. Nguni, Nat Kim Patel, the Indian referee, and the other Africans. Both of us made it into the bantamweight limit, though I had 5 pounds to spare, and Gideon was right on the limit. The sun was setting as we walked out to the ring, and already the air smelt of wood smoke and coal fires. It was still bloody hot, and I'd been drinking water all day. I wondered about Mandoma. If he'd been right on the limit, he'd have stayed off liquids, and we were fighting a 6-rounder, my first ever. It was the compromise Solly had reached with Mr. Nguni, the difference between the 3 rounds of an amateur fight and the 10 of a professional.
It struck me that if I could keep him moving around the ring, the black fighter might just dehydrate enough to weaken in the last two rounds. An old woman wearing a tired-looking fur coat over a shapeless dress was haranguing the crowd from the ring. Her high-pitched voice carried to where we were standing on the steps of the school building. As she came to the end of her talk, the crowd responded in thunderous applause. Two men entered the ring and lifted her, and two others standing outside the ring took her from them.
"It is time. We must go now, please," Mr. Nguni said, and he led us down the narrow human corridor to the ring, following a rubber electrical cord which connected with a microphone. Gideon Mandoma and his seconds had preceded us by a few yards, and the whole football field thundered to the roar of the crowd. We entered the ring almost together, though from opposite sides, and the human roar increased. Jaime and Solo were my seconds, and Jaime moved over to the black fighter's corner to check the glove up, while a large Zulu in a mismatched suit with the jacket straining at its single brown button came over to do the same for us. I could feel the sweat running down from my armpits as Solid taped my hands and gloved me up. Mr. Nguni held his arms up, and slowly the crowd grew silent. The microphone on a stand had been lifted into the ring, and his voice echoed around the field as he addressed the crowd. First he introduced the referee, pointing out that he was an Indian who had come from Durban especially for the fight. The point of his neutrality was not lost on the crowd, who gave Natkin Patel a big hand. Mr. Nguni then told the crowd that they all knew why this fight had been arranged. It was not for him to talk about it any more. The talking would now be between the two spirits, and the stronger would win and the people would know what they could think. The crowd was completely hushed as he spoke. He then introduced Gideon Mandoma, who, arms held high, moved to the center of the ring to huge applause. Mr. Nguni held his hands up for silence, and then asked the crowd to sing Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, the African national anthem. 10,000 voices sang in perfect harmony, and I shall forever remember the beauty of the moment. The yearning and love Africans put into this anthem is a hugely emotional experience. I was hard put to keep my concentration. Gideon Mandoma had the perfect reason to win the fight, and now had been given the greatest inspiration any boxer ever had. I was having trouble keeping the steel trap in my mind closed. Images of Nanny swept through my head, a sweet, dark woman who gave me unstintingly of her love, who never once mentioned the child torn from her when her breasts were still firm with milk. Gideon Mandoma had a right to hate me, and hate is a good friend in a fight. Next, Mr. Nguni called me to the center of the ring, and to my surprise the applause was just as thunderous. As I stood there he began the chant of the tadpole angel, his voice ringing out to the silent crowd. When it came time to respond with the chorus,
"Onoshobi, shobi, ingelosi! Shobi, shobi, ingelosi!"
10,000 voices rolled like thunder. I stood in the center of the ring, the tears rolling down my cheeks. It was perhaps the greatest single moment of my life. The people wanted to know. This was not a fight between black and white. It was a testing of the spirit of Africa itself. Two kids, not fully grown, on a hot summer evening that smelt of wood smoke and sweat, would decide if there was hope for white and black and colored, for the people of the great Southland.
"Maibuye Africa!" Mr. Nguni shouted.
"Maibuye Africa! Africa! Africa!
Come back, Africa! Come back, Africa!" the crowd thundered back. Handing the microphone carefully through the ropes, Mr. Nguni left the ring and Natkin Patel called us over. He had deep pockmarks over his face, which was almost precisely the color of good curry, silly as that comparison sounds. His steel-grey hair was brill-creamed flat across his head, the parting absolutely straight, with not a single hair crossing the shiny road of his scalp. He was dressed in a white shirt, cream flannels and white tackies, and looked more like a cricketer than a boxing referee. We both looked down at the ground as he spoke.
"You are listening to me, please. When I'm shouting break, you must break at once. When a knockdown is coming, I'm counting to 8, then I wipe your gloves also, and then you continue. No heads, no elbows, you must fight clean or bad.